Today we're sowing discourse with cypherpunk Madbo on hacking, government surveillance and AI, Aleister Crowley, Jack Parsons, Teletubbies and the decline of the American educational system, Hollow Earth, and much, much more. But first, I want to let you know about the ultra-high-quality green tea over at BreakawayMatcha.com. Trust me, you're going to want to buy this stuff. Directly sourced from Japan, this is by far the greatest matcha I've ever had in my entire life. And for those of us who like going deep, drinking 12 servings of this stuff got me into a zened-out state of indescribable bliss. And as a bonus, matcha's got tons of antioxidants, so it boosts your immune system in these trying times of the coronavirus. Enter one-word promo code 11JOULES and save 10% off these amazing teas while supporting our show. I'm serious, these teas are that good, so pause the video, go and buy some right now, and I'll wait. And now that you bought that delicious matcha, support us by smashing the subscribe button, and don't forget to like, comment, and of course, click that bell.
We're with Madbo.
People called me Madbo in high school, and then when I got into jungle drum and bass music, I switched it to Bo.
That was also part of inspiration for, it's like internet privacy, right? It's like common sense internet privacy.
It's nice, yeah. Like if an employer Googles my real name, maybe not all my memes won't pop up. You know, it's just a little better to have an alias for me.
I feel like I'm in a school of fish, maybe. Like I don't know if we're in hacker groups together.
I'm in a few of those, yeah.
And so it seems like those are the memes. And I was hacked years ago after college. Someone that was posing as a Paramount Pictures producer, and his name was Gary. It was a weird experience, and I'm not sure if, like, maybe you could even verify if something like this is possible, because I remember telling people this story, and I even spoke to a security specialist, and he was like, that stuff isn't possible. And I was like, no, he's literally controlling my screen. He's like pulling up photos from my phone and making slideshows. Like, I'm reading things on the internet, and he's highlighting like key phrases like over and over again, like bringing my screen back to the highlighted place.
Back in the day, there was a couple apps that let you do that. I think one of them was called Sub7. And there's a few, like I did it as a joke on one of my friends like down the street, and I was able to like open his CD drive and like move his mouse. And now security is a bit better, but that's definitely possible if someone makes you click an EXE that you could get that into it. I think lately the security by default is higher, like all these forced Windows updates, the Mac ecosystem is pretty good. But yeah, once someone gets in there, they could do it. It's funny because a lot of people that it happens to, people think they're being crazy. They're like, no, no one's watching your stuff. No one's checking your emails. But I've seen people get messed with, and it's definitely a scenario that can happen. I hope you've got it. Like, do you think your security is better now?
I don't think my security is better now. I think I've like reinvented the wheel a little bit. Like, I don't have anything to hide. Like, I just don't really care. Like, there used to be things like, I mean, I put tape on my camera for the most part, unless I like somehow am like saying like, if anyone's watching, like, I hope they're entertained or something. Like,
I should be paid for my being watched. Yeah.
I went to the police when Gary hacked me. And they were like really uninterested. They were like, has he taken anything from you? And I was like, no. And they're like, do you fear for your life? And I was like, no, like not really. And they were like, well, then like just ignore it. He's not doing anything illegal, right? And then
wait. Like, but being on somebody else's computer without their consent. Well, I guess there isn't any law against that, is there?
Yeah, that's dubious. It seems like it should be illegal to be messing with someone like that, but I'm not really sure of the exact laws.
That's the thing, is like being able to prove how he's messing with you is, it's difficult because it can make you superstitious about your tech, right? Where you're like, is this a glitch or is this a savvy troll? Your alarms don't go off in the morning, or your calls are cutting off when they shouldn't, or your GPS doesn't quite work the way it should, or you're trying to click on something and it won't open for some reason.
I know a girl like that. She was hacked, and then it felt like 75% of the things were just glitches, but she became so paranoid that like everything was being messed with that she was like just kind of losing confidence in like her house security system and all the levels of it, because she didn't really know how everything worked in the first place. So she's not sure like how her computer should be working to begin with. Like maybe it's just a glitchy file, or maybe the hackers in there messing with it. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, exactly. I just realized that like Gary became my friend. I tell people I just developed Stockholm syndrome. I was like, he was looking out for me. Like he was like, teach me what he was doing. Like he would open apps on my phone and like show me vulnerabilities on my phone. Like I can access your phone through this app. I can access your phone through this app. I can access your phone through this app. Like
that's
he was literally
wild.
Showing me like how he was like exploiting my phone. At that point, that's when I was like, well, I just have to fully submit to this guy. I was like, this guy is just like totally in control. Like he would like show, like he'd like pull up like all my cards, my social security, like my passport. Like I feel like he actually showed me his home in San Francisco. But I'm like, is that really where he lives? Like, is he flexing on me so hard that he's showing me where he lives? And then I'm like, is that really where you live? Or is this all like, is it even Gary, right? Like this, it could just be such an elaborate alias, right? Where I'm like, this is not even Gary that I thought hacked my phone. Maybe he's like, multiple different people have hacked my phone, and now anytime like my phone starts acting ridiculous, I'm like, oh, it's just Gary. Like when really it's like, you know,
that is such a wild story. Yeah
I feel like but if he's there, I feel like he is like my guardian angel.
He's probably watching us now.
That is so funny. There's a group on Reddit called the Reddit Bureau of Investigation, RBI. It's a decentralized intelligence agency, a group of hackers and computer forensic scientists, etc. Kind of like there's a show, it's called Don't F with Cats. It's like those type of people who track down internet criminals and solve mysteries. So like if I was you, and if this was happening to me in the future, or if it happens again, I would hit up the RBI and just talk to them about it, and they would be able to like assist you more than the cops would, because it's a lot of hackers and experts and white hat people.
At this point, Jules may have become too attached to his captor, so I'm not really sure what's going to be happening from here on in.
That's such a wild story. Yeah, I have a Huawei. You know how Huawei was banned, or they say it's backdoored by China? What I think is Huawei isn't backdoored. Like, I think Apple and Samsung are, but the U.S. government doesn't like Huawei because it's not backdoored. So they're trying to say that it is.
How difficult is it to find out if it is backdoored or isn't?
I think Google is working with China and America, and the OK Google is on the Android ecosystem. So pretty much anything's going to be going through Google. There's certain OSs. One is called Copper. There's a couple that are super hardened, but they're very difficult to use. Like they don't have all the apps. They're for like hardcore security Bitcoin experts might use them.
I thought it's Hawaii was they were accused of like spying and stuff, or it's just like spying paranoia. Like
it's because they do have an infrastructure and they're working with the Chinese government. So it's like they're being accused of spying, but it's like, so is the United States. Like anything that goes through the internet is being monitored. So it's
well I guess the question here is to what ends, where in Russia, for example, people get locked up for saying something bad about the Russian government. And I know that similar things are happening in China, of course. But as far as the US, I mean, we've had certain stories that may have given us goosebumps as far as, you know, journalists in self-driving cars hitting the tree.
I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, but there aren't as many of those in here as there are in other countries that are much more totalitarian. So it doesn't give any excuse for what they're able to do with this data, but at least it's letting us breathe a little better knowing that this is a country of lawyers and that there are a lot of people out there who will try to get you out of these bad authoritarian situations so the government isn't able to have as much overreach.
I feel you. I think one thing about kind of on this topic of privacy, if nothing we do is illegal, like let's say for instance someone like smokes weed, in certain states that is legal, some states not. If it's totally legal and they see you on Twitch doing it, then there's like no problem because it's legal. So I would like it that anything I could be monitored about, that I wouldn't get in trouble for, because I'm not doing anything bad. But you know, it's how they catch you in things. Like that's the issue here, is you don't want them to have all your data because at some point a totalitarian government could just turn it on you and say, okay, you said this on Twitter. It's like a type of being canceled, but
that's true. Well, just because we don't have it now doesn't mean we're not going to have it in a couple of years. I mean, right now there's this big thing going on in Virginia having to do with the Second Amendment. I still don't know what this country is going to look like 20 years or 50 years from now when it comes to certain things that we're holding sacred, like Second Amendment, First Amendment, you know, the right to say whatever you want. It doesn't mean that that's going to be the case later on if people get lazy about it. And my concern is there may not be as many people who would want to go out and march, especially if, you know, there could be different agitators that would come out of the woodwork, pretend to be on their side, and then just do all kinds of chaos. At a certain point, what I'm afraid of is that there's going to be just too much of a desire to just sit at home and play Sonic the Hedgehog or whatever, or, you know, whatever virtual reality fantasy zone people are going to be hooked into. And what do you think it's going to take for that to be undone, for people to realize how precious this world is to us, that we cannot live under a 1984 type regime?
It is a tough one, because it's almost like, because there's so much more media being shown, we're getting to see both sides of the coin. So I think awareness is increasing, but so is apathy. And there's like just different levels and layers of it. But one point you said about like how there's agent provocateurs, if you will, like, I don't know if you've seen the show The Expanse, but it kind of highlights it where it's Earth, Mars, and the Belt, and they're all at war. But all the wars are started by people who are trying to like bait, like they want to start a war with Mars so that this guy can get money or stuff like that, where it's a metaphor for our current political climate, where there's just so much underhanded, sneaky things. And generally the cover story is not what's happening. There's always like so many different motives behind what everyone's saying and doing. There's always like these other layers of it. And even if not necessarily from the beginning, afterwards people will still like collapse upon an idea and change things around. So I'm not sure the solution. I think awareness, talking about it, doing this is great, getting the word out, talking to like minds.
For sure.
When you're talking about two sides of the coin, are you kind of talking about like a systemic or governmental coin in terms of, this is probably not what you were saying, but do you think that there is a push for new future systems, like one of which could be a more global system, right? Whether it's a global government or like a freer global market or something, like it maybe has something to do with currencies and digital currencies.
It's tricky because as we move forward, if everyone gets Neuralink, for example, if everyone has a chip in their head and you can like be on the internet online with like a digital neocortex, that's amazing. And the potential for that is so advanced, but it also has the potential for the other way where like an AI could be controlling us. So it's like freedom and imprisonment, like a global government that keeps peace would be awesome, but it could also go bad and be totalitarian. So it's just, it's like the way is in between these things. Yeah. I'm trying to articulate it better, but
No, that was good. It's always interesting for me to think about whether the amount of people that have access to data today are utilizing it to the best of their capabilities when, let's say, back in the 1800s or whatever, most people were living off the farms and most of the knowledge that they knew, which was very valuable, but it had to do with the quality of their land and the livestock, things like that. They weren't really tuned in to philosophy or writing or any of that kind of stuff. Today, I see all these little kids watching these horrible multicolored YouTube videos with these really bright pink and purple colors, like I was talking with Jules before. And if we get to the point where most people are going to be in this drone mode, which I really hope is not going to happen, but if people are going to be so hooked into these devices, just receiving pleasures in the form of constant visuals, constant stimulation, they're not really going to have as much time to seek out some, let's say, more refined ways.
That's up to people, Lev, right? It's kind of like, it's almost like
it's about influences, though, from
bad
a young...
for others to feel better about yourself. It seems something that happens from a young age
in terms of, you know, how they get raised and things like that.
Different people like different things, you know. It's not some sadness if someone's like, I don't like walking around in nature and like,
yeah, but if we have an A, if we have an AI,
like, I want to like read manga or build
my
Legos
point is
or,
if we have an like, AI that's going to or, if there is is an AI that's going to reinforce certain habits in people from the get-go. That's where I can see this being more of a problem than how it is today.
So I am a transhumanist, right? So that's kind of like the spooky robot cult, but it's based on my understanding of neuroplasticity, the potential for life extension, and eventually, I wouldn't want to be one of the first people to sign up for it. I also think it would be a problem with a global government. If you do like a hive mind Neuralink, like I would want that to be like some kind of blockchain situation or something like Tim Berners-Lee would talk about, in a way where like you are in control of the information and there's no like the reason why China doesn't like Bitcoin and likes AI is because they can use AI, a small number of people can use AI to control a large number of people. Right, but Bitcoin decentralizes the currency so that governments can't even control it. So it destabilizes power to people that have it and gives more power to people that don't. Right. And I Yuval Noah Harari talks about these two different possibilities with the, you either have a one world government or basically all the different governments around the world become like different strongholds, right? They might be connected on the internet and they might, currencies might change. He sees those as the only two scenarios. I think there's something more in the middle where stronghold is one way of thinking about all these different countries, like if they don't become a one government thing, which I think would be a bad idea actually, but they don't have to have so much antagonism amongst each other. Like there has to be a way where like tariffs and things like that, things that make cooperation harder and artificially drive up prices, slow down innovation. It would be better if there was cultural unity, right? I think that's a challenge for people that want a one world government or even a more global culture, is like what becomes the global culture, right? What is a unifying culture that people can share? And so I think there's been projects to, you know, to blend cultures and like see what the cultural mixing pot churns up, right? Like just it's an evolutionary process, right? It's just, I think Lev talks about these things a lot when he talks about diasporas or like immigration at home and abroad, that some of these projects like have cultural elements that if there's too many negative feedback loops, like within a given moment, like you can have cultures that are corrosive, right? Like not all cultures are equal, right? And I think that really good linguists can make really strong arguments for why that's a controversial thing to say. But I do think these are some of the challenges with like 2020. And
I wouldn't want there to be one culture by any means. I think having many really beautiful cultures is something that creates a, you know, variety in life. It's a very nice thing. And there is one more thing, speaking of decentralization, that I'm really curious about, which is this project called Urbit, URBIT, which was developed by Curtis Yarvin, aka Mencius Moldbug. So from what I read, it's a decentralized personal server platform seeking to deconstruct the client's server model in favor of a federated network of personal servers in a peer-to-peer network with a consistent digital identity. And I don't fully know what all this means. People have been saying that this is supposed to make people's data a lot more of their own instead of being owned by a third party. So I'm curious if you've looked into Urbit and what do you think is going to be in the future related to something like that.
I've heard of that one. There was a document I have, I can send it to you afterwards, where this person analyzed the various linguistic trends happening at one time, like say on Twitter, and just gets a general sentiment of the emotional vibe of everyone. And it's saying that it's kind of almost like a esoteric, like divining, but trying to see if it matches any type of movement in these various cryptocurrencies. But in that document where he was analyzing various trends and seeing like how coins moved along with people, he said he was kind of wary against using blockchain when it's not necessarily ready, because one of the issues with blockchain is the increased security can also cause it to take longer to be more bulky and more difficult to use. So if it's not as fast, and we want it to have the speed and the privacy and all that, The storage coins, there's a couple of them coming out, but it just said be wary of all these storage coins because they're going to basically have that idea that you mentioned, which is good in theory, but will it actually work when you could like use a Google Drive instead? And so what I think it is it's just not mature yet. They're moving a lot to other forms like DAGs and Hashgraph. And it's, I think we're still calling it blockchain, but it's like beyond blockchain, different. I don't even know how it actually works. Like the models of how the Hashgraph and DAG, DAG stands for Digital Analytic Graph, I think. There's one, it's called Constellation. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
But ultimately, if these are able to be just as fast as Google Drive, why would people use Google Drive?
And then I love what Yang was saying about being paid for your data, because imagine if every post you ever made, as people look at it, you get a few cents. Like it could be like 0.0005 cents. But after your whole career online, after years, you would be getting like nice residual from all the content you've created. And if we could be paid for a data like that, or even when they're analyzing us, when we walk in the store, if we could get some of that paid back, that would be awesome. And there's a couple of coins trying to do this, and I'd love to see it.
It'd be nice if they did that voluntarily. I don't think they should pass a law to make Facebook do that, because I think it would mess everything up. But I think if enough people get together and we're like, hey, we're going to stop using Facebook, or yeah, you're like, going to change your model.
There's a Nebula Genomics. Instead of 23andMe, which just sells your data and does whatever it wants to with it, Nebula Genomics compensates for you if you want to share it. So it's like on blockchain. And it's basically what you're saying. It's like the other way if you want to do it, but it's like not forced.
By the way, not to change the subject completely, which is this is probably what's going to be happening anyway. I saw that you are a big fan of tea, and I am a big tea drinker myself. I have this really high quality tea over here, which I got from this Chinese tea master. And awesome. We have these, and Jules attended one of these ceremonies that we had. And this is tea that I've never tasted in my entire life, where once you take like the first and second, third sip, each sip is completely different, but also has all these different complex accents. So I don't know if you're a fan of Chinese tea necessarily, or where do you fit in the tea world?
Yeah, I started with like English tea time with my grandmother, like that kind of like more British style. But then I got into Gong Fu Cha, and there's a tea shop down here in Ocean Beach, San Diego, called Mad Monk Tea. And I would go there like every other day and try some of all the best teas in the world, I feel like various like pu'er's and oolongs. And there's so much complexity to it, like you were saying, that if you brew it at the right time and temperature, you can make the tea do different things and get more different flavor profiles out of it. I found sometimes we would talk about feeling tea high or tea drunk, and we found out that it kind of boosts, it's related to like cannabinoids. So it's like the really good teas do get you a little something. It's very subtle. It's nothing crazy, but.
Well, yeah. I'm kind of noticing it right now after I've just had some of this tea. But I was also told that if you stack a lot of tea leaves on top of each other and just get this whole batch in, that's actually something that can make you trip out. I don't know if this is true or not. I know. What was your experience there?
There's an article online. It's called Really, 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 Really Strong Matcha. And the guy uses like 20 times the amount of matcha that you normally should use. And it's like super thick. But he said when he ate it, he felt like a trippy transcendental feeling. And looking into it, ECGC in the green tea acts as a mild MAOI. It's a COMT inhibitor. So that's going to boost your dopamine really high. But then the theanine is a GABA precursor. So you're getting super high levels of dopamine and GABA. And so you would feel very like zenned out. Like it's a perfect zen vibe. And so yeah, definitely with the tea, sometimes we'll drink tea for like 3 hours and get kind of chill activated.
That's amazing. And since you're really big into nootropics, would you consider tea to also be a nootropic?
I think so. Yeah, I noticed Ethereum Vitalik, he drinks green tea every day. Yeah, I think as a nootropic stimulant, green tea, it's very subtle, you know, but it's good. I think it's good. It's a good thing to have in your toolbox, if you will. And then there's so many types.
What are the top nootropics in your personal toolbox?
I have to think about it for a sec. I do appreciate modafinil sometimes when I'm not feeling 100%. I can take that and I'll have a good day. Like, I don't take it often because it has a 15-hour half-life. So you want to have a 3-day washout period to let it get out of your system. And what I see is a lot of newer people get a honeymoon period with it, take it all the time nonstop, and then they get a crazy high tolerance to it.
As far as different supplements that are out there, nootropic stacks, there was one that I'm curious what you think about called Qualia, and they have a new version of it recently. It's got certain ones that I know have been pretty tried and true as far as ingredients go, like Bacopa Mineri and Rhodalia Rosea. But then they have other ones like Cognizin, Alpha GPC, Velvet Bean. When it comes to people trying this kind of stuff out, how would you know if things are going into the danger zone?
Generally, nootropics are safe to even megadose. So that's what's cool about them, is like you're generally not going to have too many issues if you eat too much of it. But one of my problems with Qualia and a couple of the other pre-made stacks is, let's say I wanted to take more Bacopa, but I can't because it's with all the other things and I don't want to take too much of, the last item on the list. So what I would recommend to people do if you want to seriously get into it is look at all those ingredients and try them all individually and like get all of them by themselves. And then you could start playing around with the doses of it, because some of those things you don't want to take every day and some of the things you do want to take every day. So, yeah, I started nootropics.com, nootropix.com when I was 18. It's kind of like gotten away from me. Like I hired some of the other nootropics admins and let them run it. And so they're kind of just handling it. And I'm not very involved anymore in it, but I am an admin of the official Facebook nootropics group. And I'll just go in there to like chat with people. I'm not like super into nootropics.
So did you sell the nootropics?
For a little while I was.
So you used to work for them, like you helped build it or whatever, but
yeah.
And then I thought you founded it and then sold it.
Yeah, kind of, basically that's where it's at. Like I'm still it's still operation and I haven't sold it, but I'm not actively working on it. It's just kind of like doing its own thing. So it's like I could hop back in there. I don't know. It's weird. Yeah, I've just let it be on the side.
Oh.
That's
interesting. It's like a pirate ship.
Yeah, I just have so many projects. Like I was throwing drum and bass shows. I was starting a tea company. I'm traveling. I love working remote, so I could go anywhere. So go where the wind takes me, I guess.
I feel like you're a very global citizen. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like you have like a really unique global perspective.
Yeah, I'm pretty hopeful for the future. Like I'm an optimist about it. Like obviously there's 1,000 scenarios where things could go off the rails and things could get really bad. But in general, if you consider how many billions of people in say just India alone are working on getting their PhD. And their goal is to like uplift the earth, because that's going to make them money. It's going to make other people happy. So you have a billion minds trying to like solve all these issues. And I think that's where really cool things are going to come through. And it's way bigger than the average person thinks is what's happening. Like the average person is generally like not very informed about all these transhumanist ideas or blockchain, what have you. But the new education that's coming up with YouTube and the internet, any kid now can watch a bunch of YouTubes and learn. Like I was taking Harvard CS50. It's on edX.org. It's free computer science classes. So right now, someone who just wants to take a bunch of Ivy League college courses can. And that's like amazing to me. So I see that future. It's probably going to be bubbles. It's like yin yang. There's going to be like dystopian hellholes and war places. And then there's going to be amazing utopias. I just hope I hope there's nothing too insanely bad, like, a crazy AI plague or something.
There could be seasteading operations that can quickly scoop up all the curious people from whatever country there happens to be this hellhole in, so they can do their programming and creativity in peace.
I dig that. Yeah, have you guys seen Silicon Valley's Ultimate Exit? It was by Balaji Srivastavan. He was the CTO of Coinbase. He started earn.com, but basically he talks about kind of like seasteading startup countries where they're outside the laws of what he calls is the paper belt, like the old way of doing things. And just that new frontier, it sounds amazing. Like there's going to be hundreds of startup companies in the next decades.
Yeah, we talked about transhumanism earlier, and then Lev mentioned, you know, people missing out on nature. And I do think people are going to be merging with machines and not everyone will do it. I think the reason why AI isn't gonna overrun us is because the AI will be us. Like, I don't think the AI will never develop faster. It'll always be like in tandem with our operating system, like at its base code. Because I do believe that our consciousness emerges from the code in our DNA. Lev, if I can try to bring up what you see as the alternative, is that maybe our consciousness is not coming from the code in our DNA, but it is somehow like a radio signal that we're receiving from a universal consciousness. And the code in our DNA is just the shape of our antenna for receiving this universal consciousness. Well,
I wouldn't say just that. I mean, DNA is used to code for proteins, so there is a whole lot packed in there, which I am quite an amateur at this point in terms of understanding. I want to understand, you know, like reading as much as I can about biology and the way the brain works, but it does seem to me, as strange of a statement as it is just with its simplicity, but if you look at a human body, it does look like a pole with a circle on top, you know, just like very standardly.
A walking antenna.
Yes, exactly. A walking
antenna. Nice. That's funny.
I think that could be true. I think there could be a tethering, and that merging with machines like will have no interference with any of that. You gain more insight about it through the merging.
I hope so. I just don't want there to be a closed loop type system.
What's that? What do you mean the closed loop type system?
Where the only knowledge that's going to be developed is not the one, let's say, that would come from somewhere else, but it would be limited to whatever it is this AI has been designated as holding within itself, if that makes sense. Like, I can't say it in any better of a way.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They have discovered that a big part of our consciousness like operates on light, and that's how the brain communicates with itself. It flashes light, and we were able to remote control a cockroach by shining lasers into its brain, right? So just by showing light like into the cockroach's brain, like that's how you move it. So it's conceivable that like when people have talked about, oh, you know, they think aliens are, you know, like incepting ideas into their head through lasers or whatever. And it's like the government could actually potentially have that tech now where, yeah. I mean, they study where they held a magnetic wand over someone's head and this person was filling out a morality questionnaire and they turned on the magnet wand like over some horrific questions, and like the person's answers were horrifying. There was like, oh, like what do you think about like war crimes, what do you think about like massacres, and like all sorts of like stuff. And it's like, just imagine like a soccer mom like filling out the questionnaire like writing it out as if she's Vlad the Impaler or something. And it was just sort of like, holy shit, like what is this magnetic wand like shutting off in her brain to like make her like that? And it does bring into question like, what is free will, right? And so I think these are the things that like give people like the heebie-jeebies when they're like talking about transhumanism or merging with machines and like messing with the brain. You know, Elon Musk did just release Neuralink. So they, and DARPA had the brain to machine interface like way before that. We have the neocortex, which is just the top layer of the brain, which has been like evolving through nature. And so the next layer is the external neocortex, or like whatever the next layer we add onto it. But it's just an enhancement to like information acquisition and processing, right? That's really what you would be using it for, right? And so it doesn't have to close off like any receiver that the brain might have. Like if there's like a part of the brain that is a receiver for external information, whether that's like what anomalous ESP things are referring to, or maybe that's sort of like the Tesla coil you go through on your DMT trip, you know, when you pass to the other side, you know, like that antenna, that nexus, right? That soul, I don't think is going to be trapped by any, you know,
I see what you're saying, but
building
just like
upon evolution.
Well, just like in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, you don't need to censor to not get people exposed to certain things if you just overwhelm them with too much information, going back to the point that I was talking about earlier. So that is something I'd be interested to see as far as how do we get a lot more curious people in the future to, you know, be curious in the first place. I mean, I hope it's just going to happen naturally. But if there was some kind of a way to induce in people that sense of wanting to try a little bit harder to avoid a lot of these, you know, distractions that keep piling on top of us every day. I mean, that goes for me as well, for anybody.
Yeah, it makes me think of, I think it was Crowley in the Book of the Law, every man and every woman is a star. And I wonder if that's literal, like everyone's actually a star consciousness and we're like beaming here to Earth. Mm. That could be one possibility. But to the point about interfacing, there's a story on Forbes.com called The Coming Artelect War. And it talks about three types of people. There will be the Terrans, which would be like Amish people who don't want to get hooked up at all. Then you have like cyborgs who are halfway, and then fully like fully AI synth, you know, what are they called in replicants? Yeah. So there'll be like replicants, AI, connected humans, and then people who want to stay out of it. And I know what you're saying, that we don't want to be so overwhelmed. Like, what if it's just constant and it's just like crazy information overload? Like, what happens when you turn it off if you've like lived with it your whole life? Or maybe that's what happens to gray aliens, like when they crash and their power goes out and they just like can't think anymore. And they're just like useless because they don't have any of their stuff. So
I can imagine that scenario. That's very funny. But also and I want to be real careful whenever I'm talking about predictions, because I think most predictions are not going to come true. And a lot of it is just people using their pattern recognition in order to fit one thing into another. But I can see why very Christian people would be scared of an upcoming time when people would, let's say, have chips implanted in them, because they have the Book of Revelation, which talks about the mark of the beast on the forehead and the arm with which you are allowed to buy and sell. Now, obviously, there is zero way that that could be proven to have to do with what we're going to go through, but there could be that little voice inside them that remembers that Revelation quote and then looks at all these articles coming out and says, no, I'm going to go live with the Amish. Hey, you guys have some more room?
I think that not all Christians have that reaction. I think that there's so many different denominations. I've witnessed Christian transhumanist groups. You know, you've got the Christian, you've got the Mormonist transhumanists. Mm-hmm. Kantbot, who's like a religious Catholic, like he has favorites, I think, in the transhumanist community. And I think that Christians, it's not transhumanism that they'd be afraid of. It's they are by design cautious. Their stories of, you know, Icarus or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein are similar to stories in the Bible when people test nature and it goes wrong. And that's imbued in the scientific spirit, right? And also in terms of coming to things in antagonizing circles. That is the best way to come to consensus. Like, you shouldn't be coming to consensus in communities where everyone's agreeing with each other on everything and it's like some infallible cult. Like, how you should be coming to your scientific advancements is in antagonizing circles so you can triangulate on truth, right? Because you're all doubting each other and trying to detect each other's errors and correct them to create better theories of existence and how it's, everything's working.
I think you're right. And just so you know, I don't mean all Christians. I'm talking more about the millennial Christians, you know, the ones who think that the end of the world is just around the corner. Those are the ones I group more into being very fearful of a lot of this technological stuff.
All that fear comes from the unknown. And if you're able to, like, show people, you know, models of our current understanding of existence, right? They can have much more informed comprehensions of what they are afraid of. Because a lot of times people aren't responding to the content of information, they're responding to how that information makes them feel. Mm. And I think this is changing, but not a lot of people see uncertainty as a desirable or exciting feature of life. I actually think that's one of the biggest things people got to get down is uncertainty is an exciting and desirable feature of life.
Here, here.
It's a way to be anti-fragile.
How about you, Matt? Are you a fan of uncertainty?
It's funny to think about. I think I like it. Yeah, it's cool. I'm not very fearful. I'm pretty positive. Like, I'm belligerently optimistic on purpose because I just know it's not useful to me to be too freaked out about how things are going. So I also think you kind of will it into being if you focus on like a positive future scenario that you want. You can kind of steer the ship, like kind of what Elon's doing. It's like, this is going to happen whether we make it or not. We might as well try and nudge it in a better direction than it could go. Mm-hmm. So.
And in general, were you always a free thinker? Were there any particular texts that you subscribed to or things that influenced you a lot in your childhood?
I was raised Catholic, and I thought that to be not Catholic meant I was a Satanist. So I got into like studying modern Satanism, which was more like, you know, humanism. It wasn't evil. And that's where I started to research like Crowley and Magick and mm-hmm. a lot of all that stuff. And I just find that
it's see the hat.
Evil. Oh, yeah, totally. Love it. Studying all that, I was trying to like, I think I got into it when I was playing StarCraft. I joined this little clan that had a hacker group. And not only were they trying to like hack enemy teams and like we had this exploit for a certain FTP server so we could do a denial of service on the enemy clans. But these hacker guys got me into magic things because they were trying to hack reality. So I started just studying all that. I don't really practice. I'm kind of more just like, you know, I'll just Google about it or read stuff on it, but I don't belong to any orders or I'm not actively practicing.
For people who are unfamiliar with magic, magick, how will you describe it? How exactly is it operation?
I see it as a hacking reality. I think it's the use of belief systems in unorthodox ways. That's what chaos magic is. There's all sorts of literature on like sex magic with it and like masturbation. That's like a smokescreen for like what it really is.
So a meta belief of being able to change your beliefs at will for whatever you want to achieve. So just kind of thinking of it in that term.
It's like the ultimate empathy test, or it's like the ultimate uncertainty test, or it's very compatible with Buddhism and the self illusion. Like if you don't think there's a you inside of you, right? If you think like you're literally just like the collection of your, you know, consciousness, I think that's how like the shape of a pagan's brain would be in terms of like someone that's more egotistic.
Well, they were calling Aleister Crowley the wickedest man on earth. What was it that got him that title?
I think he has been unfairly demonized, but he knew he was messing with hardcore Victorian Christians. So he would kind of like Marilyn Manson, like mess with them and write things and say things. I highly doubt he actually did anything that gnarly, but there's all these like stories of him doing all kinds of nonsense. And I just think it was more like he was just trying to mess with the Christians of the time to get a rise out of them, like a shock posting.
What I find to be very interesting is how one of his greatest disciples was Jack Parsons of Dredge Propulsion Labs, who was one of the keys to rocketry during World War II, and afterwards, from what I know, helped create NASA. So it's
Song from John Lennon's son. It's the Something Delirium, but they have a song about that, about Parsons. I'll try to send it to you.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting people around him. Israel Regardi, I like. I listened to some of his lectures. A very down-to-earth guy in a nice British accent, and not a drug addict. Like, that is the one thing that about Crowley, which kind of disappointed me, just how deep he ended up going with his drug addiction right up until the very end. You know, he was a dope fiend. He was,
Are you disappointed in Keith Richards?
Did Keith Richards turn it around?
He's still doing it. No.
No, he's still doing
the
drugs. He's
still kicking.
I was wondering how much he still parties. Like, is he still doing it? Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, but he does like full blood transfusions.
Okay, we'll see. That's the difference. I mean, a lot of the members of the Rolling Stones now have like a vegetarian-based diet, and they're being super ultra careful about what they do. But I don't know if somebody like Crowley, who is doing a lot of drugs, I don't know if you could keep doing that. I mean, maybe in the future they will be able to.
You gotta be. Everyone knows you gotta be careful. But anybody that's like being self-destructive, it's usually due to emotional sadness. And being disappointed in them is actually more of a death sentence. It's actually like, if you think about hacking a person's brain who is struggling with drugs, it's like it's not your intention that matters as much as the effect of your actions.
Mm-hmm. I'm more disappointed that he wasn't around for longer. I would have been curious to see what else he would have come up with, just like any other artist, you know, like, although they have that whole idea about how certain singers died at 27. If they would have remained, you know, maybe their music wouldn't have been so good, but I don't know.
This is why I don't like quoting Hunter S. Thompson on Twitter. Like, there's all these times I want to be posting Hunter S. Thompson quotes, but it's like, well, like Hunter S. Thompson killed himself,
nice.
Right? But like, I'm not even sure. Like, now I'm like, was Hunter S. Thompson, did he kill himself or was he assassinated? Like, I just like I've gotten so into some of these rabbit holes where I think the uncertainty comes in handy for not being blindsided by like I'm watching a music video with 6ix9ine with Jigsaw on his face, like surrounded by spooks. And I'm like, okay, well, like, I just want to have a good time and like get the life extension word out there. And I'm not trying to create conflict.
I'm thinking of something. It's paradise-engineering.com. And there's also headweb.org, which kind of is like about a Neuralink, but it's the guy who wrote paradise-engineering.com and headweb.org. He, I think it was David Pierce, and he's a transhumanist. But in the document, he outlines moving us into gradients of bliss that aren't currently achievable by the current human wetware. But he also addresses the issue of, because if you're so blissed out that you just like sit there and don't do anything, that would be bad. So he talks about like a dopaminergic motivational state, where you wake up feeling like $1 million, but you're motivated to go do things to feel even better. And my point with all this is coming back to a lot of these rock stars and such, I think we can get to a point where we could sustainably boost ourselves to these levels and not be like a drug addict that's getting damaged by it. It could just be like healthy, happy states of well-being and like positivity at levels that we can't even imagine. Mm,
that's very interesting. I just wonder, when it comes to all of this, including even nootropics, although to a lesser extent, where does individual willpower come in?
I know you mean, because yeah, you'd be so manic and positive, like nothing can hurt me. And just, yeah, you start to lose something there. I feel you.
It's like that idea of the Matrix in the movie Lore. The idea was supposed to be that this paradise on Earth was created, but people found that to be too fake, so they wanted it to intentionally be downgraded. So if we start from, let's say, the radical assumption that we are capable of experiencing anything we ever wanted to experience that we could imagine, all of that may be too overwhelming for a fragile mind that is not used to having power and control and being able to manipulate it in the proper way by their will. Thus, the form that they would take would be one of a fragile human being with all the things that we have come to experience in this life.
I've thought of that. Imagine we are aliens that live for millions of years and we get bored. So we're like, okay, I will incarnate as a bunny rabbit or a human and just see what that's like, because you're always out there, or if we're the sun or whatever. But
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing in Buddhism as well, where I think the Buddha outlined human beings as having a very special role in that, unlike, let's say, the heavenly gods or the jealous gods that could do whatever they want, because we have these limitations of our wetware, it makes us much more fragile. Thus, it makes us appreciate our mortality as opposed to just being in the clouds somewhere doing whatever the hell you want. And at the same time, not being this bunny rabbit that's only operating on its instincts, so it's not really able to appreciate the bunny rabbitness of the situation, which I also hope would change in the future once we get the avatar tech in. Then people would be able to see what it's like to be like a reindeer or a hawk flying around the mountains, things like that. That would be pretty cool.
I love that. Yeah, I think that'll enable us to teleport. Like, you would just go into your mind but have like an avatar of you, like across the world. And so you'd like instantly teleport there. And maybe you could be walking
different
around.
Bodies.
Yeah, yeah, you're like hopping bodies into different body.
Although Jason Rezaghiorgiani in his book, I'm not sure which one, but he was talking about how drone pilots in the future may suffer from this condition where they would get so used to piloting the drone in such a way that they would, with future technology, be able to feel what it is like to be the drone. As far as the actual shape of the this metal thing, and that becomes their new life. So that is a scarier version. Think like, I'd rather be a bald eagle or something, you know, just metal thing, and then people all their lives, like, imagine from birth onwards are just these metal contraptions that can smash people, and this is all they know. They don't.
Well, once you could do it with the drone, you could put that into an eagle's head and do it.
Yeah,
right?
But an eagle's not gonna be able to bomb people.
I've seen
except with like eggs and stuff.
Have you seen, some people think that there are birds that are actually surveillance drones?
Oh yeah, right? Birds aren't real.
That's like the exaggerated like Twitter version, but some people think that they actually can, like, they have.
I saw they did that with a mouse. Yeah, it's like walking around, and same with insects, it could have a camera in it. Yeah, so definitely there could be birds that are
I don't want to spoil Toy Story 4, but just one part of it had them being inside of a robot skunk. So that's how the toys were able to go through the human world, because everybody was afraid of the skunk when it was walking around. But actually, that was just like the toys inside. So sure, I wouldn't mind being a skunk, seeing what that's like.
Like Pepe Le Pew.
Oh, yeah. Do they show those cartoons in today's PC climate still? Like, I don't know. I haven't checked Cartoon Network.
Only on Boomerang. Only on Boomerang.
Yeah, I like Pepe Le Pew. Chuck Jones is a great animator. I grew up with all, like, those cartoons, by the way, they are like the polar opposite of those horrible iPad cartoons that the kids are watching today with those bright colors. Because, like, back then, they knew how to do not only good storytelling, good characterization, but also good color design. Like, the backgrounds, they weren't made to be that bright. And I think later on in the 70s, things started going downhill, probably from all the drugs, I don't know, like the cocaine. Because you had Scooby-Doo. I mean, sure, you could say Scooby-Doo's more, you know, more of the Doobies, But yeah. Oh, I get it now. Scooby Dooby Doo. Get it? But
oh, anyway, yeah.
But anyway, the color design in Scooby Doo, not my favorite. Too many purple colors in there. It just too oversaturated. A lot of that stuff was. So I think they were already, I wouldn't say they were losing their edge. I'd say that they were hiring people who are not as good at this stuff as the previous generation was. But that's, what are you going to do? I don't know. What was your favorite cartoon growing up?
I watched a lot of Ren and Stimpy.
See, Ren and Stimpy.
It was so wild.
It was influenced exactly by the cartoons that I was talking about, by classic WB and also by the classic Hanna-Barbera cartoons, which also retained all that good design. Unfortunately, the creator ended up, I think he ended up sexually assaulting some of the girls who were working under him, like some.
I heard something about that. I was kind of bummed. I was like, oh man, it kind of ruins it a little bit for me. But yeah, bad.
Yeah, but either way, the cartoon was great. I mean, look, you're always gonna have people like, you know, Wagner, anti-Semite, but beautiful music.
Yeah, I don't know of any other cartoons lately, but sometimes I'll see a clip on YouTube, and it's almost like, have you seen the Lego movie? Lego
yes.
movies, it seems like, you know, for kids, but there's so much like subtle embedded, like high ideas. And so some of these kid shows today that seem simple and they're bright, as it were, but there's also these messages in them that is like kind of advanced if you can catch it.
Mm-hmm. No, I know exactly.
Right, because it reflects what the creators are also thinking about, right? So. Yeah. I think the best animations are the ones where like parents can watch them with their kids, which is why like the Teletubbies, like I get really spooky vibes from Teletubbies. I wonder how sophisticated the show's creators were. It's hard for me to imagine that they just came up with a capitalist model for that show. They were like, we know something that's going to be gold and we're going to make this show and people are going to love it. Some people think that we're not as sharp as like people in the Victorian era. Pulp entertainment was a lot more highbrow. I'm not sure if there was a campaign like against elitism in terms of like, oh, that book you're reading has all sorts of references to art history or other novels or current events. I can't enjoy that. There's too many references. It's elitist. And there was this trend towards stripping elitism from content so that a larger demographic could enjoy it. It'd be easier to consume. But there's also, I think, a side effect from that or fallout from that, which is that it's almost as if you were like intentionally dumbing down people. Like imagine if you were designing a school and then like each year you look at the curriculum and go, why don't we teach them a little less in first grade? Like, why don't we teach them a little less in second grade? And like by the 10th grade, you're like, why don't we teach them a lot less? And then you just keep doing that each year to the point when it's like, yeah, you don't even need to really know dates. Like you don't even really need to know this or that. It's almost like, what was the point? Because if you look at what the human brain is capable of, and how adaptable it is, like you can put it in any environment and it will adapt. Culturally, we didn't see kids as stupid babies, but you saw kids as just little adults. Like you would find a lot more kids that remind you of Reese Witherspoon's daughter in Big Little Lies. Like if anyone's seen Big Little Lies, like Reese Witherspoon's daughter in that show talks like she's in the eighth grade. She's like 6 years old next to a bunch of other six-year-olds. And you're looking at this one and you're like, whatever they're doing to that one, like they should be replicating. And so I think that she probably wasn't watching Teletubbies because it probably would have made her sick.
You know what you're making me think of is I think they're running movies by people. So let's say they're the Ghost in the Shell, for example. They do a test screening and afterwards they ask, like, what did you not get? What did you like? This or that. And if you have like a soccer mom, someone who's just generally uninformed and like, et cetera, this little sample, they're like, I didn't get it. So the movie, I did not like the live action one because they cut out so many of the awesome philosophical points that made the first one so brilliant to me. They just like don't even mention it. And it's just like so stripped down. And I'm like, why did they do this? It's because they like ran the numbers and saw they're going to make like more at the box office, they think, if they dumb it down.
But once they already see the movie, though, that soccer mom was already, she already paid the ticket. So what are they losing by adding all this other stuff in? Is she going to tell her friends, don't watch this movie, it's too beyond me? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, people have a lower tolerance for stuff, right? Like, people could read longer books, could watch longer movies, could sit through longer lectures, and they wouldn't get bored. They wouldn't lose the trains of thought. And these days, our attentions have been codified differently through like all these competing inputs. So I just think it's a cultural thing, and I think it's actually very easily corrected. I think part of the problem, though, with the Hollywood system, like, I think it's artificially expensive to make movies. There's artificial monopolies on the distribution systems. Like, I think that the culture would be self-correcting a lot faster if there were less regulations, if prices weren't artificially expensive. But still, everyone has a camera on their phone now. People are doing all sorts of new stuff. I don't think Vine and TikTok are like the end of innovation. I think that you look at Joe Rogan doing 3-hour talks, you know, Martin Scorsese doing a 3-hour movie. Like, the taste for that stuff is still out there. And the more you have people celebrating long form content, the more you'll just have, you know, those fragments, you know, in culture. Not everyone has to enjoy the same stuff, right? But I think the idea that we shouldn't make something because it's too inaccessible, I think that kind of pessimism is subsiding, and people are realizing that people love complexity and length and depth. If it's good, it's good. People will gravitate to it. In the Crew book, I read this book by Nick Land. There's like a weird Teletubbies chapter in there. It's total farce. It's total satire. But it's like you read this whole book, and then at the very end, there's an epilogue about this like Teletubbies conspiracy. And you're just like, why? Why they put this in here? And it's almost like they're overshooting a target because they're trying to like get people to wake up to something like ElsaGate or something, where it's like, imagine you have Michelle Carters out there who are literally deciding how to curate content based on how much they think it's going to fuck you up so they can dominate you.
That is definitely a wild topic, and I'm not sure how truly hypnotic Hollywood is, but if you consider just the prevailing cultural narratives that are being put out, there is a subtle push for just people to behave certain ways and believe certain
things. It's not even a narrative, though, right? Yeah. Because if you literally make people incapable, and I think this is unintentional, I don't think this is part of a conspiracy, but this is like a symptomatic thing going on, is like, if people have become incapable of long attention spans, and people have been made incapable of having a tolerance for reading a long book or watching like a 4-hour movie, forget like, you know, a 2-hour movie or something.
Everyone complained about The Irishman because it was 3 hours.
Yeah, right? It was like, I didn't think it felt that long at all, right? But I can watch Lawrence of Arabia. Like, I love Lawrence of Arabia. Like, 4-hour movie, it's great. It doesn't matter that it's 4 hours. I want to know, Matt, what are your favorite conspiracy theories?
That is a tough one. Let me see. Some of them I probably shouldn't even get into because it could be like get me in trouble. But one thing that is funny is that the United States of America was founded by a conspiracy. They conspired to get rid of the British and like throw it. So this whole thing is founded on one. I would say there's a book, I think it was Cyber Magic by Lewis Carroll, or I forget who, or Phil Hyde, it's one of those guys, but he said any conspiracy will be undone by internal conspiracies. And so that kind of gives me hope whenever I think there's some crazy BS happening, that there's like other internal BS that's going to ruin the main bad thing that's happening. You know what I mean?
Are you talking about some kind of banking conspiracy?
Yeah,
you won't get in trouble. You can say whatever you want. Just like,
basically anything that's happening, if it has impure motives, if you will, then they're going to do it to themselves on the inside as well. And so it ultimately, I think, ends up not being as bad as it appears on the surface. Does that make sense? Yeah. I'm trying to think of some. I'm actually not super into it. I do wonder about like UFO tech. I've heard that like DARPA and a lot of the government projects are like 20 years ahead of what the tech that they're showing us is. So I think a lot of these UFOs are actually just like prototypes of like other types of interdimensional drives. Like there was a guy talking about somehow using insane amounts of energy to do something with argon gas, and it's something happens at the quantum level that it basically makes it have zero mass. And once you get to zero mass, then you can travel at insane speeds and not die. And wow. He was kind of like, I'm stoked for the idea that at some point, this AI that can generate scenarios will be so advanced that it could like triangulate the whole history of reality off of like an atom, just because it could like run projections on it. So we could ask that AI, like, how do we make, you know, this UFO, or what really happened with Lemuria and Atlantis? And
that would be how like femtophotography can see around corners, because light particles bounce around. Like some of those particles are actually bending around corners, and then they're going into the sensor, and then the sensor has like a computer that pieces together all those light refractions. And then they like, it can like show you a projection of what's going around the corner.
That's gnarly. Yeah, I've heard of the femto scale in that how we keep going smaller, like our phones get smaller, the microchips get smaller. Maybe we all slowly go down to the femto scale, like in the far future, just because it's more efficient. And we realize that there's like hundreds of femto things all around us. I don't know.
It's everything's going to keep getting smaller. It's going to keep getting smaller. It's going to go on forever.
There was a movie that like that recently where they shrunk people because of overpopulation. So they made like
teensy. Oh, I saw that on an airplane. Yeah, it was really silly. Small. Yeah, he like goes there to live.
I learned about Hollow Earth from you. The reason why I go around telling people about Hollow Earth.
Wait, I thought I was the one who broke your Hollow Earth cherry.
Huh?
I thought I was the one who broke his cherry.
It could have been you first and then Matt, but I could have sworn it was Matt.
I do love that. Like, I'm skeptical about it, obviously, because it's hard to wrap my mind around it, but it also seems plausible. And just going down that rabbit hole to like research it, it's super interesting, like all the stories about it. And it would make sense that if all the planets have like cores, and that's where a bunch of species are maybe existing right now.
Isn't there a UN treaty that says we're not allowed to go to parts of Antarctica? Do you know anything about that?
I have heard that you're not allowed to go there, and I think if you try to like fly a drone out there, they'll like shoot it down. So there's something's weird with that for sure. You can take expeditions to like the edges of it. I thought about going to check it out actually, but it's like,
well, the edge, that feels like a tease,
right?
you're so close to where you want to explore, but not really, so it's just like hanging there in front of you. But what I'm curious about is the diary that this admiral named Admiral Byrd, that a lot of this mythology about Antarctica comes from. How legitimate is this thing? I mean, we're talking about people, you know, talking about this diary, this book that supposedly chronicles how he went into this secret civilization under the earth, but it's just a book. How the hell would anybody know whether it's legitimate or not?
Yeah, he could have just like gone off course somehow and like didn't know where he was. Like, it's kind of
or it could be a forgery. I mean, why?
Yeah, that too. And he could just be like Big Fish. Like, he could have just been telling a tall tale like to entertain people. I'm not sure, but there's been other reports of various like ancient Tibetan manuscripts that talk about like Shangri-La and these other places that almost seem outside of reality, like right next to this reality, like, or b- behind it, or I don't know how to.
Well, a lot of that I was reading about in this book, Patrick Harper's Daimonic Reality, where that is where he would categorize a lot of these UFO abductions and a lot of fairies or centaurs or whatever things people like to imagine, that these would not exist in our physical realm, but these would be the realms of imagination, not of a personal imagination, but of a shared, like the collective unconscious, that would be present for people to, whether they're in inebriated states or for some other reason, they would be able to not only interact with, but to have some other like weird physical scarring that goes away, or some other kind of little telltale signs that they'll never be able to make out anything of, which is the funny thing with all these stories, right? Like you get this crappy photo of Bigfoot, you get all of these things that never really show you what these things are. They're just like half there and half not there. People easily dismiss them. But what Patrick Harper was saying was that that's kind of like the whole fucking point, that the way these things are arranged are in a way to just fuck around with whoever it is that's experienced it, so they'll never actually be able to show definite proof of their experience.
That's lame. That sounds lame.
I know it's partly disappointing. But think of it this way, though. If it was not that lame, if we actually found out for sure what was going on, that would change the entire history of humanity. If everybody knew
That's always true. That's always true. You know what I want to know about? So wait, so we're in that group, Meme Jokes for Normal Folks. So is that like a hacker meme group, right? I've told people that's a hacker meme group. Or is it? Or what is it?
We're just messing around. So my friend, Joey Garrity, he started a meme group. This is funny. This all ties into some of the other meme groups. He started a group called Do You Know What I Meme? And at one point when he was being like a vocal Trump supporter, I got into like some arguments with him and I ended up like leaving his meme group. So then my friend Brian started, Do You Know What I Meme? No, Meme Jokes for Normal Folks. And it's funny because like no one in there is normal, but it's just like nonsense posting. It's kind of silly, but it is like interesting to have like a fire hose of all the memes of the internet, like because I can see like Twitter, Reddit, a couple of these groups. Oh, so me and Joey made up and became friends again, and he told me to start Cryptocurrency is Just Boneless Money, which we then called Insane on the Blockchain. So I own Insane on the Blockchain.com.
I thought that was way first, because that was that used to be, what was it? Cryptocurrency is Just Boneless Money, Interoperability.
it had a bunch of names. Like I changed the names like every week. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think I was just spamming cryptocurrency memes in the meme group so much that I was like, okay, I'll just start a group in and of itself. And then my friend Tyler was like, oh, let's start throwing a crypto night in San Diego. So we had like techno and crypto. We did a crypto techno event in LA. And then my other buddy, Rio, who runs Circuit System, started Crypto Cult with us, and we made some shirts. Not this one, but so that was a funny like.
Are those all aliases?
Yeah, CryptoCult.com or CryptoCult.net. That's like that's a clothing line. Insane on the Blockchain.com is like, so that we throw parties. It's kind of like died out a bit. Like, remember when everyone was all hyped about it like 2 years ago? I think it was around like October. Everyone was so stoked. Now a lot of people who got disillusioned with the like crash, if you will, or how Bitcoin went way up and down, a lot of people bought the top. And everyone I noticed in all my groups got very quiet. Like they'd be all talking a lot when Bitcoin was at like near 20K. And then now generally most people are not talking about it much, or there's a couple of friends that are still day traders and they'll tell me various signals every day. Like I hear about it. Just different projects and coins.
I love all these memes. These guys that Lev has brought into our like our internet fold, the Autistic Mercury, like they have a Discord and they have all sorts of crazy memes. Like if you look at their ecosystem over there, and it's like I've seen some memes that are just, they're so horrifying and terrible that some of them like catch you by surprise and like really make you laugh, and you're like, it's just because it's just like so much where you're like, this is just over the top on another level. that humor is laughter is a coping mechanism for things that make you uncomfortable. Some things that make you uncomfortable make you go like, huh, or like you don't react. And some of them like hit you with a laugh, and it can be like a variety of laughs. Like I've never met one person with one laugh, right? And so I think that, you know, memes are art now. I think it's like a weird new kind of Dadaism. And Lev took me to an event where someone was putting memes into an AI system that they didn't design. And then they printed out this new...
Oh, like AI generated?
They printed out an AI generated meme from whatever they put into the system.
Oh yeah, there was a guy, he took pictures of other people's Instagrams and sold them for like 90K each. And I was like, what the hell? And he didn't even compensate the people that it was of.
Because he had changed it, right? Because he included the Instagram window and the comments. And according to the user agreement of the Instagram and the way that he was including all that information there and then reprinting it and putting it on a canvas, it was like its own thing. It had been changed.
That is wild, and I do think it might be some weird money laundering scam, because like who's gonna pay $90 for
I think most fine art is money laundering.
A lot of high art seems to be in that category. It's not surprising to me at all. I was in the art world so that I could make a lot of money.
I am in the art world, sort of.
Anyone with their laundering, so it's probably why I'm having so much trouble breaking into the industry.
Jules, I'll get back to you about that as I learn more about the industry, but I don't know if you know this, Matt. I'm the chair of the Art and Technology Committee at the National Arts Club in New York City in Gramercy Park. So I am constantly around people who are within this world, but the guy recently, the banana guy, the guy who put the banana on the tape, like from his own words, this whole thing was supposed to be like a parody, even though he made money off it. He did not treat this seriously for a second. But there are artists who do put crap out there that they treat incredibly seriously, and so do the people that give money to them. Now, we've been fortunate at the Arts Club to have a lot of really actually beautiful pieces that people would put on and admire, so I'm happy about that. But there's always going to be a lot of crappy things in the art world regardless. So I think that it's a matter of mimetically being able to influence those communities as well to look at things with a much sharper eye.
Similar to what's going on with the banking system, because it's the relationships between the galleries, the museums, and the magazines. And so you have these relationships that are nurtured and cultivated in all the industries. And so they have their own feedback loop. It's like its own religion. It's almost like the art world. Like, that's why I've learned to stop seeing religion as some sort of other. Like, some people have religion and some people don't. Like, I've kind of learned that everyone kind of has different degrees of religion or even like cultish behavior. Like, if you start thinking about each individual family as a cult, or like each company culture as a cult, or like you start to understand how things organize or are organized. And I think that there is a kind of ivory tower, outdated aspect to the high art world. And it could be like a real bubble. Like, who knows if there was a big economic crash and Bitcoin became the dominant currency, like what would happen to a Jeff Koons? Like how would all the prices reset, right? Because I think some things like Van Gogh and Picasso, like would probably, like Leonardo da Vinci, like Michelangelo, like some things I think would absolutely retain their value. Some things, I wonder how long they'll retain their value. Andy Warhol, I would not be surprised if like his stuff decreases in value over time. Maybe it never will. Maybe it's actually impossible for that stuff to ever decrease in value. But I have a suspicion that Andy Warhol is like the CIA has the secret art collection, And I think one of the artists they would have in their collection is Andy Warhol. I think that he was part of a CIA psyop, whether he knows it or not.
I much more prefer Gustav Klimt, who was an artist of early 20th century Germany. He used to wear a big robe because I think he was always transmuting his sexual energy into his artwork, but I think he was also coming all the time. So that was, you know, back when everybody was supposed to be prim and proper, yet you had artists like that who were on the forefront of the art world that did not necessarily play by those same rules and were allowed to do that in a way, kind of like Diogenes from ancient Greece, that philosopher who they say used to live in a barrel with the dogs, and then he used to just poo everywhere, you know, in the street, and it was okay because it was Diogenes. It's fine. Now, if you did that, or if you did that, different story, you know, you'd never be heard from again. But I'm always interested in who are those people that are at that same kind of wacky forefront, getting away with certain things that others cannot. I mean, in terms of science, you know, you had Nikola Tesla, who was friends with a pigeon, but that wasn't as in everybody's face. But there are, I don't know, are there that many people today that would qualify either as a Diogenes or as a Nikola Tesla? Because it seems like we have all this information out there, but it almost seems like the last century or so had so many of these very iconic people. I don't know, maybe there are and we just don't know about them today, and we'll know about them like 50 years from now.
If there are some around, I'm not sure off the top, but like there's that one guy, he's always in his underwear and he talks about love. I forget his name, but he's very wacky, but almost trying to be like a Zen saint or something. I don't know.
The guy at Union Square that like beats a drum, is that the guy you're talking about?
Yeah, he's always just like, love. Let me see what his name is.
I know that guy. He's in the same neighborhood as the guy that walks around with the cat on his head. There's a guy in Union Square that walks around with a postured cat, like sitting on his head, like it's a bust.
Reminds me of like Vermin Supreme.
Oh, yeah, with the shoe.
He's like, give America a boot worth licking.
I mean, these are all interesting people, but Diogenes was a philosopher first. That's what people remember him from, not just walking around being crazy. See, that's the difference.
I think that with pagan religions, it's like astrology, where you can think about all of those as having aspects, like all of them as being aspects of your personality and aspects of other people's personalities. Like, I think, was it Herodotus that said, like, anyone that thinks, that believes in the Greek gods is an idiot, right? As in, like, they didn't even believe in the Greek gods. They just, they used those narratives as, like, universals to share with each other and to understand like their internal nature and the internal nature of others. It wasn't like, you know, some kind of a determinative, like, you know, pigeonhole. Yeah. People in Ireland, like in their parliament, like blame fairies for like things going wrong with like bridges and stuff. Like that literally people, and I dated the girl whose father was the diplomat to Ireland for a little bit. But I remember that's when like my Facebook feed started showing me like, this is the state of like Ireland's parliament. And it's like, this guy's blaming the fairies for like why they need more funds to like fix a bridge. And it's like, how are those people doing over there? Like, what are they talking about?
Funny thing about fairies is you're used to thinking of fairies as being like these little people. Fairies come in all shapes and sizes. Like there in Ireland, there's a tradition of there being fairies who are actually taller than us, are supposed to be like these almost godlike people who are much, you know, more beautiful than us and are like a warrior caste and things like that. So it's pretty wild once you get deep into the lore of how
people perceive
fairies.
Maybe if beings live on the sun, you'd think of them as an angel or a demon, depending on if you were scared or not. But these could be these avatars of these fairies and such.
That's true. Fire is a very spiritual element. It's been throughout time, like the Zoroastrians and I believe the Mithras, even before them, worshipped fire. Heraclitus talked about how fire was this prime element that creates our reality. He's the same guy who said that you can never step into the same river twice. And he also had a very interesting way of, at least people interpret it this way, of looking at the world, where the world that we're currently in right now is actually the world of death. Everything's constantly decaying. Like, as soon as something is born, it just starts to decay, like all the cells start to disintegrate, while the world of actual life is like our dream world or whatever world.
Horizon, right? It is our dream world currently, and we have to bring it into reality. This would absolutely be great.
That'd be awesome. I had a really awesome time chatting.
This was a lot of fun. I've wanted to do this for a while.